This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Help me welcome to the program Eric Lomazoff. He is a graduate student at Harvard University and the Wilson Carey McWilliams Fellow at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, online at millercenter.org. Eric joins us live from his office at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Eric, how are you? Happy Monday.
Oh, happy Monday to you, Coy. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Been looking forward to talking to you. I'm looking forward to learning something here about the Bank of the United States. You're writing your dissertation. It sort of combines political theory and the study of the history of American politics in writing about the bank. Now, before we get into the bank, we don't, just to clarify, because I'm truly ignorant about this kind of stuff, we don't currently have a Bank of the United States, or do we?
Well, that's a very good question. There are some economic historians who jokingly refer to the Federal Reserve as the third bank of the United States, so it's probably heads or tails on that one.
Okay. So we have the Federal Reserve, which is a confederation of banks. It's a network of banks, right?
Yes, yes. Okay.
But once upon a time, American founders, the founders of this country, some of them had the vision of creating actually a national bank. And take us back to the beginning of this thing, Eric. Take us back to the 18th century and set the stage for us. What was going on? Who were the advocates? Who were the detractors? And why was there even discussion about needing a bank?
Well, I think the most important fact that you can keep in mind when you're thinking about the origins of the Bank of the United States is a problem that we're very familiar with today, and that's the problem of public debt. And I think when we're talking about the 18th century and public debt, what we're really talking about is the debt after the Revolutionary War. And so one of Alexander Hamilton's main objectives when he entered into his office as the first Secretary of the Treasury was to sort of, his term was improve the public credit. That is, he wanted people who were America's creditors, whether they were, citizens of the United States or whether they were people living abroad, to have confidence that the U.S. government would pay back what it owed. And the bank was one among several devices that Hamilton thought was going to be particularly helpful in raising America's public credit.
And Eric, at that time, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that at the time, there were only a handful of banks in the country. They were all state banks, and there were a number of different currencies. I mean, there really was no national currency at the time.
Yes. In fact, all the way down until the Civil War, you have about just as many currencies in the country as you do banks. Each bank would issue its own currency. You can still see examples of this floating about now and again. I've got a book with obsolete paper money sitting on my shelf. But, nothing like what we would today refer to as the greenback. Certainly, all paper money did not look the same.
And was this Hamilton's vision for a U.S. Mint and one national currency? Because I also thought that Jefferson was the one who came up with the idea of the penny, the nickel, the dime, the quarter, the dollar.
Right. So the system of coinage and the U.S. Mint, it's technically a separate policy question, and I think that Hamilton and Jefferson probably had more agreement about those sorts of issues than they did about the bank. But the bank is certainly, one of those institutions which is going to be working with the coin of the country. After all, gold and silver were part of its capital and were part of the bank's capital all the way down until 1836.
So we're talking with Eric Lomazoff, a graduate student with the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. He's studying at Harvard University, and we're talking to him live from Cambridge. So how did Hamilton, tell us about the politics behind this, how did Hamilton get his bank, the first bank of the United States, despite fierce opposition to it, including folks, Jefferson and Madison were very opposed to the idea?
Yes, yes. So I'll tell you one fact which you and your listeners can keep in mind, and I think it applies from 1789 all the way down to the present day, but it was certainly influencing what Hamilton was doing, and that is there's really no place in the U.S. Constitution where Congress's power to create a bank is clearly spelled out. And politicians have known about this, and especially those who don't like national banks for whatever reason over the course of American history have used that fact to their advantage. Politicians advocating for a bank have tried to focus on very specific pieces to make their arguments, but Hamilton knew this, and he knew that he was going to face opposition on this front in 1791, and he spent probably a sleepless night. You know, we talk about college students, pulling all-nighters to write papers. Hamilton pulled an all-nighter to write a paper for President Washington defending the constitutionality of the bank. Jefferson, Madison, Randolph, they probably got more sleep on the matter, but they wrote long speeches or reports talking about why the bank was not constitutional.
But Washington signed the bill all the same, is that right?
Yes, Washington signed the bill. Oddly enough, he didn't say anything. Washington could have simply let the bill pass into law. It was the end of his 10-day window, but he never said a word. And because the bank's charter ran for 20 years, he really didn't have to say a word. I might also add on this point, I should have mentioned it earlier, that there were a fair number of people at the time who thought that even though there were members of Congress who were complaining, you know, the bank is not constitutional, there's no power for Congress to do this, but there were a fair number who thought that actually that sort of rhetoric was camouflaging a deeper issue which was at play, which is that the Congress had recently decided to move the national capital from Philadelphia to Washington, from Philadelphia to the area near the Potomac River, and that was going to happen in 1800, and there were a lot of people in the South who were extremely fearful that if you built the government's main financial institutions in Philadelphia, that would somehow prevent the ultimate removal of the government to Washington. And as such, there's some argument that they actually constructed their constitutional opposition, that it's just a smokescreen for what they were really interested in.
So we're talking with graduate student Eric Lomazoff. He's writing his dissertation on the history of the Bank of the United States. So Washington signs this bill into law, creates this first bank of the United States. And what year is this?
This is 1791.
And it has a 20-year lifespan. Tell us about those 20 years.
Well, I've got a full chapter on this. I think it's the most fascinating period in the bank's life. So when Hamilton writes his long defense of the bank, he points out that the bank is going to perform a number of functions for the government, and it's going to provide some services to the commercial community. And in today's parlance, we would call all of those services fiscal. The bank would provide loans to the government. The bank would provide loans to private businesses or individuals. It would transfer money if the government needed it in another part of the union. It might also make payments on the public debt, those sorts of things. And the most interesting thing that happened to the bank during that 20-year period is that it also came to exercise other functions. We could look back today and call them central banking functions. I think that's a little anachronistic, but they certainly involve regulation of other institutions, of other banking institutions in the country. And this has consequences down the line. Some people will tell you that Hamilton knew this all along. He knew that the bank was going to be a regulatory institution. I don't really buy that argument, in part because, as you noted earlier, there are only a couple of banks in the country at the time, and you can't really talk about there being a regulator of a banking system if there is no banking system to speak of. And as the number of state banks grew and as the interactions between state banks and the national bank grew, you really started to see the national bank find itself routinely in a position of power over these smaller institutions. It could control the amount of credit that they could extend, in essence controlling the overall money supply. And while the while the individuals who governed the Bank of the United States thought that they were performing a very useful function for the country, there were surely individuals who were governing state institutions who did not think very highly of what they were doing.
We're talking live with Eric Lomazoff. He's the Wilson Carey McWilliams Fellow at the Miller Center of Public Affairs. He joined us live from his office at Harvard University, writing his dissertation on the history of the Bank of the United States. Eric, let me ask you this. I find this so fascinating because what interests me most is not the nuts and the bolts of the bank and the lending and the monetary policy, but the personalities behind them. Is it fair to say that Hamilton really understood that a Bank of the United States, as the first Secretary of the Treasury, could be an incredibly powerful tool at his disposal, and that it would bring him a certain amount of power? If you want to understand Hamilton, you have to appreciate the fact that he really understood power. That this was a way for him to have power in that political environment that he might not otherwise have.
Yes. I mean, he was certainly aware of what the potential was with this institution. He had studied the European banks. In fact, he drew upon them when he was thinking about how to design the Bank of the United States. There's a famous story that one of Hamilton's biographers tells about when Hamilton is assisting George Washington during the Revolutionary War, literally, you know, hiding under a tent at night, reading you know, basically economic histories and taking notes. So this is a guy who was very interested in this from a very, very young age. And so when he was Treasury Secretary, he not only understood the power of the bank, but I think this is definitely a point in his favor. He understood that he also needed to be separate from that power in some significant degree. And so Hamilton has very, very regular contact with the Bank of the United States, but he's not the president of that institution. He's not a governor of that institution. And in fact, we have examples of the Bank of the United States actually, you know, going off and acting in ways that Hamilton had not prescribed. Not necessarily the sorts of things that angered him greatly, but, you know, sort of going off and doing what children do, which is sort of outgrowing, or not outgrowing their parents, but, you know, growing up and making decisions on their own.
So the Washington creates this first Bank of the United States. What was the reaction of the state banks? Did they chafe at the power grab and the control that this national bank was wielding over them?
Well, it's a very interesting story. I would say yes and no. It really depended on where in the country you were. Some of them actually thought that they were going to merge with the national bank. The Massachusetts Bank right here in Boston, their plan was that they weren't even going to fight the Bank of the United States. They wanted their bank to become the Boston branch of the Bank of the United States. That's not exactly what happened. In Providence, the Brown brothers, the individuals who eventually formed Brown University, they decided that what they really wanted to do was bring a branch of the Bank of the United States to Boston. I'm sorry, to Providence. Had to correct myself there, to Providence, because they thought that that was the way to indicate that Providence was a growing commercial center. And in Virginia, there was a push to charter state banks as a way to keep the Bank of the United States out of the picture. They didn't want the federal government's institution intruding into local affairs.
Interesting.
So there's a really varied reaction to the bank.
Yeah. So what happens in 1811?
In 1811, you get a really interesting fight in Congress about what to do, whether to extend the bank's charter. And it's a really close vote. In fact, the bank recharter bill fails by one vote in the House, and it's actually a tie vote in the Senate, and the vice president breaks the tie against the bank. It's an interesting fight in part because after the bank has changed as an institution, after it's become a regulator of state banks, you're not really talking about the same issues anymore. I mean, some of the language is the same. You have people in Congress who are, again, talking about the bank not being constitutional. But more often than not now, you're talking about state banks that have one of two interests here. The first interest is one of gain. The Bank of the United States is holding the deposits of the federal government. If state banks can get their hands on that money, they can profit from it as well. They can't profit from it in any direct way, but they can make loans knowing that they have these deposits as part of their assets. And the other factor involved here is that there's genuine discontent on the part of many banks about this power that the Bank of the United States is exercising over them. And the thought is also that probably their own operations can be significantly expanded if you can just get this enormous monkey off their back. And so it's a close vote, but you see a lot of moderate members of both chambers, both the House and the Senate, who are talking about state banks and the sort of pressure that they're getting from state banks to wipe this national institution off the map.
My guest is graduate student Eric Lomazoff. He's talking to us live from Harvard University. He is the Wilson Carey McWilliams Fellow at the Miller Center of Public Affairs, writing his dissertation on the history of the Bank of the United States. Eric, before we break here at the bottom of the hour for local news, very quickly tell us about the War of 1812 and how that sort of set the stage for the rebirth of what we now call the Second Bank of the United States.
Well, the War of 1812 is really interesting in part because it happens at the absolute worst time. Remember, I pointed out earlier that one of the reasons Hamilton wanted a Bank of the United States was so it could lend money to government, particularly in times of need. And the War of 1812 comes a little over a year after the Bank of the United States dies, and the government immediately has to engage in some deficit spending, which they fund through bond sales. But this is a little bit of counterfactual history, but you can imagine, had the Bank of the United States been rechartered, you would have seen government going to the bank and asking for loans to fund the war. There's a second argument to be made, and this is more in the regulatory vein, that that the bank, or the absence of a national bank, is responsible for the fact that in about August of 1814, many of the state banks south of New England actually suspended the payment of gold and silver for their notes. So you saw the depreciation of paper money. It manifested itself as inflation. That's how consumers felt it. But one of the arguments in the post-war period was that it was because there was no regulatory institution that state banks had to suspend their payment of their paper in gold and silver.
So that was a period then of what we might call today massive deregulation.
Yes, that's right. 1811 is definitely the first sort of deregulatory moment in American banking politics. Absolutely.
And it wasn't very good for the average citizen.
Well, it wasn't very good for the average citizen. Yes, that's right. I guess the real question was, was that deregulation a mistake? And that's a question that scholars of the bank have argued about for a long time.
We are talking with graduate student Eric Lomazoff, live from Harvard. He is a fellow at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. And Eric, we'll take a break here for a few minutes, and when we get back, we'll pick it up where we left off, and we'll talk about how Congress looks at perhaps bringing back the Bank of the United States, and we'll talk about how they brought it back, and it still didn't stay alive for very long. We're talking with Eric Lomazoff, a break for local news and weather. This is Charlottesville right now. Let's rejoin our conversation with graduate student Eric Lomazoff. He has joined us live from his office at Harvard University. He is the Wilson Carey McWilliams Fellow at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and we're talking about the history of the Bank of the United States. All of this, of course, Eric, precedes the Fed that we all grew up with and that we know, but this is how the Fed was born, right? This is the backstory.
Yes, definitely. I mean, you had the people who were thinking about how to design the Fed in the 1910s, definitely looking at the history of the Bank of the United States.
So we'll go back to this era right after the War of 1812, during which there was no bank. The first bank of the United States had lapsed and died. It was a period of intense deregulation on state banks. So take us to Congress now after the War of 1812. How was the second bank of the United States created?
Well, you know, during the break, I was thinking about your comment that it's the personalities in history that really interest you, and maybe the most interesting personality of all emerges during the fight to recharter the Bank of the United States. And it's actually not Andrew Jackson, it's his nemesis, Henry Clay. And the really interesting story with Henry Clay is that Clay was a senator from Kentucky in 1811. So he was actually part of the debate about whether the bank should be rechartered. And he gave a long and impassioned speech about why the bank shouldn't be rechartered. And there's some evidence to suggest that maybe he had some interest there. Maybe he owned some stock in two, you know, state banks back in Kentucky. But the more important point is simply that he was opposed to the bank. Now, if you fast forward to 1816, Henry Clay is now Speaker of the House. Now, that by itself is interesting, how somebody would go from the Senate to the House and not the other way around, but that's another story. The important thing to remember is that Clay now flip-flops on the issue of a national bank. He's sort of the original flip-flopper. And the Democrats make him pay for this, you know, 20 years later. But Clay comes out in the 14th Congress, and he's very honest with both his fellow members and with his constituents back home. He says, "I made a mistake. Had I known then what I know now about the services that the bank performs, including making sure that state banks pay gold and silver for their notes, I would have never voted for the bank to go out of existence." And in fact, he's one of a number of members of the 14th Congress, including also John Calhoun, who sort of revisit the old constitutional debate over the bank and say, actually, there's a stronger argument, and they point to another part of the text as a way to sort of justify bringing the bank. Bringing the bank back to life.
So Henry Clay was against the bank before he voted for it.
That is correct. He pulled his John Kerry, yes.
We're talking with Eric Lomazoff, who's writing a history of the Bank of the United States. So the second Bank of the United States is chartered then in what year?
It's chartered in 1816, and the interesting fact there is that the president at the time was James Madison, who had also opposed the bank, except he had done it 25 years before. So Madison's signature is affixed to the bank's recharter 25 years later.
Interesting, another flip-flop. So, I mean, what happened in the interim? Did they just realize that, wow, Hamilton was really right on a lot of things? We do need a national bank.
Well, there was some talk about that. Like the bank is important for the government to conduct its finances. But really, at the end of the day, it's this expectation about what Hamilton didn't know, this regulatory power that the bank had. And everybody in Congress was extremely hopeful that the Bank of the United States could successfully encourage, or if it got to this, force state banks to go back to paying gold and silver for their notes, end the inflation that Americans had been suffering with since the middle of the war, and also force those banks to sort of maintain that standard going forward.
So during the life of the first bank for those 20 years leading up to 1811, did Congress and the political leaders sort of discover this regulatory arm that they hadn't foreseen, that even Hamilton hadn't really foreseen, and did they see perhaps that, wow, we really do need this to keep the economy on the straight and narrow and to keep it afloat, that this is a tool that we need as a Congress?
So this is a really interesting question, and I've struggled with this myself. I mean, it is undoubtedly the case that people on the inside of the bank knew that they had this power, and they worked to make sure that they used it in what they thought was a just manner. It wasn't clear to everybody else that it was just. And it's also clear that there were some members of the Washington establishment who knew about it, but there was really not much that could be done at that point. The bank had a 20-year charter, and in 1811, when the bank came up for recharter, you could visit the issue then. And in future Congresses, you see either the House or the Senate more aggressive in sort of doing investigations of the bank's conduct. But during the first 20 years, there was little that they could do.
So is this a period in American history then where we really see America discovering what we see today on the headlines in our newspapers is this strong regulatory arm of a central bank. Today we call it the Fed, but it was the first and second bank of the United States back in the early 19th century.
Yes, I mean, this is definitely a period where even if Americans sort of don't know how bank regulation works, even if they might entertain doubts as to whether the Bank of the United States could actually successfully do what it was recreated to do, that is, you know, make these state banks pay gold and silver, they were at least hopeful. And their representatives and their senators were assuring them that this was the last and probably still the best hope for reaching that outcome. So, you know, there were other policy ideas that were considered by Congress, but this was the one, you know, with recent history in mind, this was the one that they thought was the best option going forward. And so they revived an institution that they had killed just 5 years before.
Wow. So what was the fate of the second Bank of the United States?
A little like the fate of the first one, except there's bigger personalities at play. So Congress actually passes a bill to recharter the Second Bank of the United States in 1832. And Andrew Jackson doesn't take his full 10-day window as Washington does. He authors a long and very famous veto message, which lots of college students read, maybe even high school students. And he thinks the bank is unconstitutional, sort of on the merits of the question, probably thinks it was unconstitutional in 1791 as well. But more importantly, and this is maybe the most critical fact to remember about the 1830s fight, Jackson is really concerned about banking as it relates to representative government as a whole. And his big concern is that you've got a largely independent but very concentrated group of individuals who are exercising extreme power over the American economy. They're headquartered in Philadelphia. Nicholas Biddle is the president of the bank at the time. He is sort of the institutional nemesis of Jackson at this point. And of course, if you look at some of the really interesting cartoons from that period, you see Jackson and Biddle in a sort of life and death struggle.
So Jackson's opposition to the bank had everything to do with Jackson's populism.
Yes. Yes, I mean, Jackson had some personal experience, some personal unfavorable experience with banks, which his own biographers have treated, but this was really about Jackson saying, we are not going to have independent and very powerful concentrations of authority that are completely divorced from government control.
And it sounds so much like Jefferson, and Jefferson always referred to the stock jobbers and the money men who rivaled the power of the government. For Jefferson, of course, the government was the voice of the people, and if you have too much money pooling in one place and concentrating in society that can rival the government, then you have a threat to democracy.
Yes, this is very much in the Jeffersonian tradition, and I was looking at a couple of quotes from Jefferson before we came on the air, and I noticed that yes, it's the same sort of thing, that what Jefferson and Jackson are worried about is the sort of corrupting influence of the bank, and it's not just that it's going to corrupt the government, but it's going to corrupt the morals of the people. That this is an affront to Republican virtue, if that's what you want to call it.
We're talking with Eric Lomazoff from Harvard University. He's a fellow at the Miller Center of Public Affairs and working on his dissertation, The History of the Bank of the United States, which, of course, is the backstory to the Fed that we live with today. So did Jackson effectively kill the Second Bank of the United States?
Yes, but it was a rather long an arduous process, and it probably did him some physical damage if you take a look at some of his letters. So it's, you know, it begins with the veto in July of 1832, but the bank was operating with a 20-year charter. It wasn't going to die until 1836, and Jackson was impatient. I mean, this is something that we know very well about him. And so in 1833, he wanted to sort of get going with it already, and he ordered the Secretary of the Treasury to remove federal deposits from the Bank of the United States and put them in state banks. Now, the really interesting story here, and Coy, you'll have to tell me what this reminds you of, but the Secretary of the Treasury refuses, and so Jackson fires him. and he brings in a new Secretary of the Treasury, this individual also refuses. So finally, Jackson gets a third Secretary of the Treasury, actually an interim Treasury Secretary, Roger Taney, who goes on to be Chief Justice of the United States. And Taney is the one who finally removes the deposit. So you definitely get previews of events in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, it's Nixon Saturday Night Massacre all over again, isn't it?
It definitely is. And, you know, I just have to tell you, I was really impressed with myself when I read the history of that, and I immediately thought of Nixon. But then I was reading a book that John Kenneth Galbraith wrote, and he apparently had the thought long before me. But, you know, I can still comfort myself with the thought that I'm not in bad company.
You're in good company, indeed. So the Second Bank of the United States dies, and before we let you go here, we've just a couple minutes left, but how did we get to where we are today? I mean, when was this born? And of course, all the lessons are there. I mean, the First Bank and the Second Bank, that is the huge backstory to the Fed that we have today.
Well, the Bank of the United, I'm sorry, the Federal Reserve that we know today comes out of the Panic of 1907, which I'm going to have to confess is sort of outside of my range of expertise on this. But, you know, if we're talking about the Fed and how the backstory of the Bank of the United States has meaning for the Federal Reserve today, what I would say is the following, that, you know, as we've talked about, the Bank of the United States came to exercise powers that it wasn't born with. You know, it became a regulator of other institutions. And when that happened, the politics surrounding the institution changed in significant ways. And so by the time Jackson kills the bank, we're talking about very different issues than we were talking about in 1791 when Hamilton creates the bank. When I look at the Federal Reserve today, I see something like the same thing happening. We hear a lot of talk about the Fed being transformed into what's called a systemic risk regulator. I have to tell you, I have no idea what a systemic risk regulator is, except for this fact. The Federal Reserve operates as an institution that regulates its member banking institutions. But the idea of a systemic risk regulator involves the Fed sort of reaching into the broader American economy and affecting the operations of a whole host of other institutions which are not banks. The only argument that I would put forward for those who are interested in taking a historical approach is this is going to change it's undoubtedly changing the Federal Reserve. It will change the institution's politics going forward, and I think the consequences of having the Fed sort of encumbered with so much responsibility, the consequences of this, if they happen to get it wrong, could be disastrous. They could be the same consequences that the bank met in 1811 and in the 1830s.
And once again, history is there as our guide with these valuable lessons for how we've tried it in the past, and it's so fascinating. What a fascinating topic. Eric Lomazoff is at Harvard University. He's also the Wilson Carey McWilliams Fellow at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, online at millercenter.org, writing his dissertation on the history of the Bank of the United States. Eric, I've really enjoyed it. Great stuff.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.